Thank you for everyone to show up today and listen to our War College Talks. This is the second year that we're doing War College at Celesticon. I'm Dana Lombardi, and we've listened to several good speakers today, and we have a whole slate of them. In fact, tomorrow's program is even longer. So what I'd like to do is talk about Stalingrad today in my lecture. And could you turn down the lighting just a little bit?
Yes.
It might be a little easier to see. One of the things about Stalingrad is that the company that I am now an owner in, called 1A Games, has as a book imprint publisher my Lombardi Studios. But we are coming out with, and this is an advanced copy, Stalingrad is going to be an expansion, a campaign expansion for Tide of Iron. So it has little toy soldiers in here and tanks and all kinds of cool things, and I'll talk about that a little bit later. But I was able to go through that and help authenticate the game based on the years that I spent researching it. Everything you're going to see has come out of, literally, I mean, I never really stopped doing research and learning as much as I could about the battle. When I first started doing the research, it was the mid-70s. I think we showed it at Origins when the convention was on Staten Island and SPI was the sponsor. It was the first year that somebody other than Avalon Hill sponsored Origins. I think it was 1977. And we had a prototype, we had a playtest prototype mock-up of Streets of Stalingrad, and it came out in 1979. So the material you see here that I'm going to talk about, all this historical information and this research data came out of the research we did on learning about the battle. As you know, when game designers are trying to figure out how to make a game, you have to study both sides as best you can, and you have to come up with what are the...
I'm okay.
Are you okay? You have to be able to understand their doctrine, not just their order of battle, not just their strengths, but also how did they fight, what were the differences between the armies, and what were the main factors that influenced the battle. So you get to pretty much know a lot about a particular battle or campaign. Now, obviously, we had captured German documents to work from. So we had war diaries that survived. Some of these were just gathered up and flown out of the pocket before the Germans surrendered. So a lot of the war diaries, like at the Army level, 6th Army and Corps level, 51st Army Corps, survived because they were taken back to Germany before the surrender. Some of the divisions, their war diaries were captured or destroyed when the Germans surrendered in the pocket at Stalingrad, and so those are gone. They may exist in the Russian archives somewhere, but no one's ever seen them, and I doubt that even they could find them at this point. The Russian information, obviously, was not as available because it was the middle of the Cold War. It was 1970s when we were doing our research, and the few books that were out, Treikov, who was the commander of the Russian 62nd Army at the battle, had written his memoirs. They may have been actually ghost-written. But they had been translated into English, and almost everybody's book after that in English has used that book as the basis for their research on the Russian side. And then there were other things that were available, but most of the information we got about the Russians came out of the German archives. Because obviously one of the most important things that you do as an army is your intelligence gathering, okay? So you're doing it through radio intercepts, you're doing it through prisoners, you're doing it when you capture documents, when you overrun a headquarters, and you help piece together a story. And so when we were doing the research of the German stuff and reading everything in German, it was telling us about the Russians. The interesting thing is now that the Soviet Union is gone and the Russian archives are more accessible, at least they have been, one of the guys who was a real fan of the Streets of Stalingrad game just got it in his head that he wanted to learn everything there was about the Russians because we didn't have access to that. So he not only went to Russia and Volgograd to do his research repeatedly, he married a Russian woman who helped him with this research. He's gone into a lot of archives. And after all this time, the only thing we got wrong were like 3 or 4 designations on the Russian side. That's how good the German intelligence was, okay? Now, he has more details. For example, we have pay records, casualty records in Russian. Because both armies, they're all bureaucracies. Every day there's a guy, whether you're winning or losing, and last day in Berlin, there's a German sitting there at a typewriter, right, typing up the report. Well, the Russians are doing this too. You know, the unit is being overrun. It's like five guys left, and he's doing what he's supposed to do. He's like tagging up the last thing. Hopefully he got out. Apparently he did, because the last one that says they got five guys left in the unit is filed somewhere, all right? And that piece of paper has been scanned by this guy who is, Russ Schultz is his name, and he is amazing. Detail perfectionist, because he's got stuff from the Russian archives. And so what we're going to do is upgrade our Streets of Stalingrad game, and we're also going to have a whole line of products, books, and other things, because there's some amazing things that he found and we still have about the Germans. So I'm going to tell you about the battle, and I'm trying to start with like the overview and not worry about the tactics until the end. We're going to say, how did we get here and why did we get here? Well, one of the things you need to know is that Stalingrad was really unique, because even though Warsaw was bombed and Warsaw had been hit by artillery, the Germans did not do a lot of street fighting in Warsaw. They did not do it in Paris at all. Obviously, it was declared an open city. And they did not do it in Rotterdam, even though they dropped paratroopers, okay? And those guys were pretty cut up, all right? They did not do street by street, building by building, street fighting in any city up to this point. Oslo, again, was like an open city. Most people didn't want their cities destroyed, or, you know, a show of force was enough. So even when you had Kiev and you had other major Smolensk, Minsk and so forth, as Tom just pointed out, the Russian doctrine at the time in 41 was, we are not going to fight inside the city, okay? It destroys the city. So this is not a good thing. We hope to get the city back. So one of the reasons for the motivation of not doing it is that you want to be able to reuse the city. And guess what? The guys attacking don't want to destroy the city because they want to be able to use the city also. Okay? So we're going to take a look at the strategic considerations and then talk about why this all went pear-shaped. Okay. So as you know, most of you who study the Eastern Front, the Germans invaded Russia on June 22nd, 1941, and they went way into Russia, okay? And the reason they were able to do this, even though they had a limited logistical tail to provide them with the things they needed to go into Russia, one of the ways they did this is by simply taking all the fodder and the food they needed for their troops and their horses. They just took it from the Russians. And as a result, millions of Russians starved to death. I mean, that's how they dealt with it. That's how they logistically were able to keep themselves. And that way they focused on artillery shells, on gasoline, and all the things they had to do to keep the panzers moving forward and the troops continuing to go in. So by the December of 41, they're literally so close to Moscow they can see the spires of the Kremlin. And it's at this point that the Russians are able to bring from the Soviet... I'm going to use Russians and Soviets interchangeably. Technically and historically, the accurate thing to do is to say Soviet soldiers, Soviet government, okay? But, you know, for all intents, even during World War II, if you read the books, everybody's saying Russians, okay? Even the Allies are saying Russians. The Russians, when they had their propaganda, are saying Russians, okay? But technically, it's the Soviet Union and the Soviet government. Because the Japanese did not attack the Soviet Union, all those troops that were in Siberia, there's many divisions of troops, were able to come to the western part of Russia and counterattack, which you see here, which is the winter counterattack by the Soviets outside around Moscow. And these attacks were the first major defeat of the Wehrmacht, or actually the Heer, the army, the German army in World War II. I'm not talking about a small battle like a Stone in France. I'm not talking about Narvik. One division of mountain troops was basically thrown out of the town. We're talking about Army Group Center. Dozens of divisions were stopped and thrown back by the Russians. And this is the first major defeat. You can see that, you know, the scale here is like almost 50 miles in some places where the Russians changed the lines. It was the first time this had happened. So it's a lot of people look at this, historians now are reevaluating and say, no, this is the turning point of World War II. I disagree, but again, you can see why they would say that, because it's the first major defeat that the German army, Das Heer, is suffering. So it doesn't succeed as much as the Soviets are hoping, because the Russians, the Germans are not destroyed. They're thrown back. They do survive. And there's a couple of pockets that hold out that are surrounded by Russians at Chom and Demyansk. And the reason I'm bringing this up, and the reason this is so important, is at Chom, there's about... Chom has about a division's worth of troops, and Demyansk has almost a quarter worth of troops that are surrounded by the Russians, and they hold out all through the winter. And how do they hold out? Because the Luftwaffe keeps them supplied, even during the winter, and they're able to keep these troops, about 12, 15,000 guys in one pocket, 30 to 40,000 guys in the other pocket. This is really important, because one of the things that's going to be said when Stalingrad gets surrounded is that, you know, Goring, what an idiot, promising that his air force is going to keep them supplied. He already did it once, okay? No, he never did 240,000 guys, but the principle was the same, and the Germans had a very low opinion of the Russians' capability to stop an airlift. Yes?
One of the things that happened in Stalingrad was that the Russians pushed a tank car through the major German airfield and caught about 200 Ju-52s by surprise. And so you had this mass takeoff of hundreds of German transport aircraft from a single airfield all at once, while they're being shot at by a Soviet tank corps.
Yep.
And the crucial thing was the Soviet tank corps took out all the German refueling trucks. And that crippled
them. Right. But don't jump ahead. That's the pocket. So that's way far too ahead.
Yeah.
So basically, the Soviets have a counterattack. It throws the Germans back. This is going to be very important because this changes everything on the Eastern Front. One of the things that happens is that the German commanders, who up to this point have been attacking, moving forward, Guderian, for example, who has Panzergruppe 3, has been arguing with Hitler whether to go and surround Kiev, how to push on Moscow, blah, blah, blah. And he's arguing with Hitler about this. But everyone basically up to this point obeyed Hitler in terms of what his orders were and so forth. Many of these commanders, the German commanders, retreated. It was made sense, saved their troops and so forth, but they didn't ask for permission. And this is not one of those things where, the famous saying, it's better to ask for forgiveness than to ask for permission, and that's what the Germans were trying to do here. It's like, we'll tell Hitler we had no choice later, right? We'll get forgiveness. That's not going to work, okay? I'm going to show you what happened. Okay, Hitler is livid, okay? You pissed off your boss in a way you cannot imagine. Remember, what did Hitler do in 1940 when they overran France and conquered Belgium and everything else? Boy, he handed out awards, field marshal's batons, right? Generalships, estates. He just left, and all these guys are now wearing knight's crosses and everything else. But by the way, when you have a knight's cross, you get a bonus, okay? It actually helps you in your pay. The little things that people don't think about, it's like not just a nice little looking award, okay? There's actually money that goes along with this. Okay, so Hitler gives out all this stuff, and these guys all retreat. No one even asked me. Yes?
Wasn't von Rundstedt and Guderian, were they reappointed later?
Yes, much later, when things are going badly for Hitler. But right now, here's what happened. An army group, there are three army groups that the Germans have on the Eastern Front, North, Center, and South. So you've got Wilhelm Ritter von Lieb, who was fired in January. Now, it was he didn't retreat, okay? But he just isn't taking Leningrad, and basically Hitler's like, you know what, I need a new guy here, because his guy is not doing the job. So in this whole round of firings, he goes, and he's replaced by von Kukler, okay? Army Group Center, you don't ever heard of these guys, right? Some of these guys you never heard. There's a good reason why you're never going to hear of these guys, all right? So Army Group Center is Fedor von Bock, who is fired from retreating, and he's replaced by von Kluge, okay? Army Group South, von Rundstedt, who you probably know because of taking over in the army groups in the West in 1944, is fired for retreating. He's replaced by Walter von Reichenau, who is the commander of 6th Army. So von Reichenau goes up, this is normal, goes up, and his chief of staff is Paulus, Friedrich Paulus, and Paulus goes up to command the 6th Army. So this is normal, hierarchical, normal succession plan. And then also gone, remember, Guderian, that Hitler's already pissed at because he keeps arguing with him, right? I'm sorry, Panzergruppe 3, he's fired.
Okay? I thought became 2nd Panzer Army.
It was Panzergruppe 3 in 1941. It became Panzer Army 2 in 42, okay? They changed the name. Okay, he was fired for retreating, along with 40 other German generals, who usually you don't even hear about. So this is a wholesale, just get rid of these guys, all right? So Hitler made his point, right? The boss made his point. And this is really, really important, okay? Because the guys who now are in those replacement positions as commanders, what are they thinking? It's not just I don't mess up. It's like, I'm not doing anything that Hitler doesn't tell me to do, okay? I am going to do exactly what he says. I'm going to find out how he's leaning before I go off and do something. So this just kills initiative. All the things that the German army has been winning on by their commanders in the field showing initiative at high levels, army group, army, panzer group, right? Corps.
What do you expect?
This is just hammering that initiative, because the guys who replace it are really nervous about their job positions. And even though it's a war, yes, they are worried about job security. I mean, it is their career, right?
Didn't von Rundstedt not too long after taking over from Rundstedt as or we're jumping again here?
Let's just go here. So the front line is enormously long. If you ignore the Finnish front, which is lightly held, okay, and you just look from Leningrad down to Rostov, right? It's like 1,500 kilometers. It's huge. I mean, you can't really hold it like a World War I battlefield where you dig trenches. That doesn't exist. You have like pockets of strong points that have observation posts. And what you do is the guys try to filter past you and get past you, you call in artillery, or you have forces that counterattack, okay? You literally cannot have a manned line that long. You don't, neither even the Russians don't have enough troops. Okay, so what happens is, in the spring of 42, with all these new people in place, Stalin thinks that the Germans are done. Zhukov disagrees. He says, you know what? We thought we had them right there in the winter, and we did push them back, but you know what? The Germans really are resilient. This is amazing. We shot our bolt, right? And Stalin says, no, I'm a military genius. I want you to attack again. I want to go back to and show you where that attack happened. Okay. Now keep in mind, remember, the Soviet Union has this massive army, right? Okay? And the only place they can attack, that Stalin has the troops, is down here at Kharkov in the spring. One little tiny area when you look at a map like this.
Why was that the only area they could attack?
He ran out of troops too. Here's what happened in 1941. The Russian army has 3 million men. What were their losses in 1941? 3 million men, okay? Now, what Hitler and everybody didn't realize is they had another 6 million men that they could pull in, and they're going to, okay? And when the war is over, what are the Soviets' losses in, not civilians, but just their army manpower? 7 million, okay? They're going to burn through the next 3 million and start to work at the next group, okay? So there's a reason why there are mortar units of all women, okay? There's a reason why they're not doing things the same way they did in 41, 42. But in 42, in the spring, the only place they can attack is down here at Kharkov. What happens? The Germans, bang, just wipe it out. And that's, by the way, is Paulus, who's a competent commander. He's not an idiot. He's a competent professional officer. And the Russians just put their head in a sack, and guess what? It gets cut off, okay? So this reinforces the German attitude that, okay, we overextended, right? We did it over the winter and we got slapped, but you know what? That's an aberration. The Soviets are just clumsy. They can't do this, and we're going to hold the initiative, and they do. They still hold the initiative in 1942, and it's the closest the Germans are going to come to win the war by knocking out the Soviet Union. What does most of the damage in World War II, no matter whose side? The armored forces. The armored forces are the thing that are going to be able to punch through, surround the enemy, disrupt their communications and everything else. And it's the panzer forces and the German army, the tank corps and tank armies and the Soviet, and of course our armored divisions. These are the things that are going to cause the most damage because they're also the best offensive weapons you've got. Well, the strategic situation in the summer of 1942 is that the Germans have a total of, I think it's 24 Panzer divisions. Okay, in Army Group Center, you can see there are 10. There are 9 in Army Group South. Africa, we have 2, the 15th and the 21st Panzer. The 21st is actually created there in Africa. In the West, refitting, we have 3 new divisions coming into existence, and we have 3 converting, and that's SS units. Okay, they were motorized infantry. They're now becoming what they're calling Panzer Grenadiers, which is sort of hybrid, but technically they have just as many tanks as like a Panzer division. So you've got, it's business as usual. We're just, you know, and the intention here is the German army thinks that when they were all done, we're probably going to have about 36 Panzer divisions. Right now they're up to like 24. But what's interesting to me is, remember that what they come up with as a plan is this. We can't attack everywhere because we lost too many troops in 1941. We can only attack in one area. Where should that be? Hitler is in favor of the south, down here. Why? You can probably see Maikop, Astrakhan, and then you've got the Baku oil fields. Oil. These are the only places the Russians can get their oil, except being, you know, imported from the west. So Hitler wants to take these economic resources, obviously deny it to the Russians, but take it for Germany. So he's going to go south. You would think that if you're going to attack in the south, where do you put your best troops? Who's going to lead the attack?
In the south.
Yes, that's a common sense thing, isn't it? But here's what they do. 2 things happen. They know that as a campaign rolls on, tanks break down. They simply just break down, and it's like a ball of string. You know, if you hold a ball of string and you hold the end of it and you throw it, how it gets smaller and smaller? That's what happens with a Panzer division, because even if they don't fight anywhere, that ball of string gets smaller because guys keep breaking down. They do have a recovery, a trained recovery service that gets those tanks back and running. But, you know, after a month or two, if let's say you had 100 tanks in your division, you may be only operating with 30 at any one time. So what the Germans did is they took one of the 2 battalions of tanks from these guys and added them to these guys. Okay? So these guys increased by a third, and these guys were now cut in half. All right? So that's one thing they did. But why didn't they use any of the really good tank divisions? Most of the Germans have experience at this point, but 1 through 10 fought in Poland. They fought in Belgium. They fought in France. Right? They fought in the first campaign of Russia, and there were 10 new divisions that were formed, and those fought in the first year of Russia. Okay, so they still have battle experience, but the first 10 are like top of the top, right? Absolute top of the top. Where are they? They're all right here. Why would you leave your best ones there? Well, what did you just do? You took half their tanks away, right? So if you're going to take half of their tanks away, who do you want to have left to fight with? Your best guys, right? That's why they left the 10 divisions there. And these divisions were the ones higher numbers, including one of those brand new ones I told you about. The only German division that was all cavalry, all horse, was the first in World War II. They had millions and millions of horses pulling artillery, pulling wagons, but combat division, they had one, just one in the German army at the time. The SS would form a cavalry division also. But at this time, the German army had one cavalry division. It got converted into the 24th Panzer Division. Okay? It's never fought as a Panzer Division. Now, it's an elite unit. It's the number one cavalry unit. These guys are great horse riders. Not going to do them much good with tanks, but they have cohesiveness. They got leadership. You know, they know how to fight, and they were in the campaign in the first season in Russia. They just hadn't any experience with Panzers. So they're going to learn on the job, okay? And then the other guys here, there's going to be 2 other divisions down here, the 23rd and the 22nd, and they're never really going to be completely formed. They're sort of in place, but they're never going to really fight major battles. And again, it's like, I'm sitting here scratching my head saying, if this is the main thing, if this is the main operation, shouldn't you like put more in there, not less? And I mean, literally, there's 10 divisions here, half strength. There's only 9 here, of which 3 are brand new, untested. So I think there's 2 things going on here. Again, this is my interpretation. I don't offer this as, because other historians have shown this. When I look at this, what this tells me is the Germans have utter contempt for their enemy.
Excuse me, let me get a drink.
The Germans, who of course we all know, have the racial superiority thing about the Superman, and the Slavs or slaves is basically their slogan, okay? Everyone else is inferior. It's not just Jews, it's like, you know, definitely Slavic peoples are inferior, okay? And this just proves it, because they were slaughtered. We got 3 million of them killed, wounded, or captured. So we don't really need the best of the best, do we? Give those guys a break. Let the B team go. You know, the guys that were on the bench most of the time, let's let them go do it this time, okay, this period. I mean, literally, that must be part of the idea, because logically, this is not making any sense, okay? And having the SS units pulled back here for something in the future, because there's nothing going wrong for the Germans in their mind, right? There was a setback in the winter during the Russian counterattack. But Africa, Rommel's kicking butt with what he's got. We occupy almost all the rest of Europe. An invasion, if it's going to happen, is so far away, it's a joke. You know, and America, please. You know, it's going to take them a year, at least a year, to even get any substantial troops into Europe. So we've got time. We, Germany, have time to finish off the Russians. And that's what this is all about.
You would call the Stalingrad side shuffle in the old world, the original album, Hill Stalingrad, when you've kind of filled a hole, you shuffled some troops into the hole from each side.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. I'm looking at this and I'm saying maybe the Germans had some problems shifting all the core support troops. They weren't shifting the whole divisions because there was a problem with railroad logistics. They could pull up one tank at a time, nuts, and point out 75,000 to 50,000 real tons of troops.
Both Russia and Germany on the Eastern Front, you can track infantry divisions like in a corridor like this. You can see them through the whole war this way, and then when they're retreating back, okay? The Russians, you can follow their infantry divisions like this. With only a few exceptions, do you take infantry and shove it all the way over here, okay? Why? It's just not efficient, right? These guys march one from one to another. On the other hand, when you look at the tank armies, when you look at the tank corps, bam, 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 they're all over the map. When you look at the panzer divisions, here, 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 and they mix and match so that it's not the same corps. These corps were reformed. They're not the same corps that they were in 1941. So what you do is some of these divisions didn't even exist, so they created a new corps, okay? Which means, yes, you have a new logistical tail, you have a new administrative tail, all those things. But you have guys that are up and coming, they learned experience, and literally they're going to learn on the way through this campaign. So that's the strategic situation. Now, there's another aspect about this. The chief of staff for the German army, and he kept his job remarkably, was Halder, okay? Halder survives the war, and at the end of the war, when the Allies capture him, he says, you know, I was in on the plot to kill Hitler. They just never discovered that. And a lot of people have written this off as, this guy's just, you know, trying to, you know, kiss butt, because his side lost, right? However, they do have evidence that Halder was talking with the conspirators, okay? And anyone was, you know what happened to Rommel, because he had talked to some of these conspirators, okay? He was forced to commit suicide. Halder somehow gets out of this. The reason I bring this up is I kept scratching my head about why did this all go bad for the Germans? You'll see that this is one of the most mismanaged campaigns of ever. They have all these advantages. 1940, this is terrible. It's lousy, right? Well, I already told you about what I thought regarding the contempt the Germans have. But if your chief of staff is also trying to mess this up, okay, and what evidence do we have? In 1941, when they invade Russia, there's the Kiev pocket, there's the Minsk pocket, there's the Orel pocket, there's all these pockets where they surround Russian troops, and once they're surrounded, they basically have time to take care of them, destroy them, most of them surrender, right? And that's where you get your big casualties, your big victories. There's almost none of that. There's almost none of this in 1942. There aren't any big... You can see that it's 4th Panzer Army, which we'll see on the edge of Stalingrad. 6th Army, there's Paulus. The 1st Panzer Army, this is where your army is. You said Grupa? This is where they're called armies now, finally. And then you have 17th Army. You notice that? It's like interspersed. Panzer infantry, but wait, we're going to spread those out. We're going to give the infantry armies some panzers too, some panzer divisions. So now we're sort of spreading it out. That wasn't what you did in 41. Why are you doing this in 42? You know, it's like if Halder is trying to make a case that I intentionally tried to mess things up as best as I could within the German headquarters to make this not work for Hitler, this is his argument, basically. He doesn't say this, but I can see that this is not competent, okay? And as I told you, there are the guys who are the new commanders down here, okay?
I think that's the next one. Let's take a look. Is it?
Yes, okay. So this is not going well. There are no encirclements, no massive surrenders of Russians. Stalin has finally listened to his generals, and from this point on, he stays basically out of it, okay? He no longer sticks his nose in as, I'm a genius of a commander. Zhukov says, just give up the territory. Don't stand there and get surrounded. They can't do it 100%, but it's much less, also helped by the fact that the Germans are not attempting to make giant encirclements, okay? So Hitler is fed up. So after about a month of this campaign, month and a half, he says, what the heck's going on here? This is ridiculous. We're getting nothing other than some territory. So what he does is von Bock returns to command because von Reichenau died. This is really, really important because von Reichenau is a hardcore Nazi. He is not SS, but he is a Nazi Party member. This is important because von Reichenau survived. Remember the firings of everybody and over the winter when they retreated? Well, he did too. But his purity of Nazism is what saved him, okay? And if anyone could get Hitler to change his mind, it would have been von Reichenau. Even though he's a von, even though he's nobility, he was a Nazi. And Hitler listened to him. When he drops over dead from a heart attack, okay, all of a sudden, you know, and I don't know why Bock got returned, but Guderian didn't come back, Rundstedt didn't come back, and you would think they'd do that. Apparently they really irritated Hitler to the nth degree, and he was just, well, not going to use them again. Yes?
Yeah, I read an account, I don't even know how accurate this is, but a long time ago, but it basically, I use this, basically, Guderian just would not back off arguing with Hitler. And that's probably why he was on the show.
Well, Hitler argued with Hitler.
Right. He just would not back down, and Hitler said, fine, you're gone. And von Rundstedt, von Rundstedt was tired of the old, actually was retired when the war started right before.
Yes, he was. He's old. He was, yeah. And Hitler wasn't going to bring him back. He thought I needed a younger guy, so that's why Bock came back. Anyway, so yeah. Bock, even though he came back, he was fired. He's back. Nothing's happening. You're fired again. Okay? So Bock, who's commander of Army Group South, is gone. And now it's split. Because Hitler says, I want the guy to concentrate just on going to the oil fields and the other guy to protect his flank. That's all I want you to do. So they bring in List. He's going to be fired September 9th because guess what? He never gets there, does he? He never makes it to the oil fields. And Hitler just loses his patience. And then Army Group B goes on to Stalingrad, and it's Maximilian von Weichs, who is the commander. And he holds his job by not doing anything, okay? When Paulus gets sucked into Stalingrad, when Paulus is just messing around, the 4th Panzer Army under Hoth, okay, is sitting there going, don't do this, right? Don't put your panzer divisions in the city. Don't even attack the city. Just go around it. And Paula says, you can't tell me what to do. I'm an army commander like you. And so it's like, well, Weichs should have been able to step in and say, you're right. We're going to do it this way. And Weichs does nothing, okay? Nothing to interfere with this. He just lets it go. He lets it go down the tube. Okay, so on the 24th of September, I told you, Halder is fired. Because everything, it's been now June, July, August, September. 4 months, they have not one strategic objective captured. After 4 months, nothing's going on. Halder, you're fired. In fact, I can't get anyone to do anything, so I, Adolf Hitler, am taking over personal command of Army Group A, and I'm running the general staff. Okay? What's this going to do for personal initiative? Is there anyone going to do anything now as far as personal initiative? It's just the reverse of Zhukov and Stalin. Stalin finally voluntarily steps back and says, you know what, I'll let you guys run it, because if you screw up, you're going to go to Lubyanka, right, prison. But I'll let you do it.
Yeah, nice resort.
Right. You do it. You do it. You're
already
fired
Zhukov once.
Yeah. Yes. Okay. So no one wants to anger Hitler, but doing exactly what Hitler asked also gets you fired. So there's that one. This is a Dilbert cartoon. Okay. This is a typical thing. If I sent this to Dilbert, he'd love it, but I know he wouldn't draw Hitler and have Wally, you know, interacting with him. It would ruin freedom like that. Okay. So, on to Stalingrad, right? Here it is on the Volga River. It is an important industrial center. It absolutely is an important industrial center. It's one of the major cities in Russia. It also popped politically, propaganda-wise. It's named after Stalin. That's also a good reason to go destroy it. So, 6th Army. This is Army Group B, and you have 4th Panzer Army down here. They switched sides. You notice when they started, it was up. It was like this. So the Panzers sort of went behind and cut in like this. And 6th Army went along the Don River, and they're coming down towards Stalingrad, and 4th Panzer Army is coming up here and protecting them.
One major point. Stalingrad was also, before the German major breakthrough, a major rail center, and it was where the German-Russian rail lines converged.
Mm-hmm.
However, when the Germans made their initial breakthrough, Stalin ordered that a parallel rail line be built to the east of Stalingrad,
mm-hmm.
so that if Stalingrad came under fire, the Russians would still have some north-south communications with the Caucasus.
Right, they needed that, because they didn't have anything otherwise. They had to build that
railroad. This required stripping railroads elsewhere, but Stalin ordered it, and I'm saying that's what saved the Russians' ass, was running that north-south railroad.
Well, also, it didn't hurt that the Germans were running this campaign incompetently.
Okay. Yes. If they had, it would not have saved the Russians if the Germans had gone east the way they should have.
All right, now I said, you can say, Dana, you promised there were no encirclements. Okay. There were, but they were minor. 62nd Army, which is going to be Chuikov's army in Stalingrad, this is the first time it gets destroyed, okay? And basically, it has 5 divisions. There are a couple other divisions that get out of it, but basically 5 divisions go in a small pocket, and they're destroyed, okay? This is where 4th Panzer Army is doing what it's supposed to, okay? But it's doing it on a very small scale, all right? One army gets surrounded in this whole campaign, and that's 62nd, ironically, okay? Whereas we know at Kiev it was like 7 armies and they were much bigger, okay? So this is the difference in scale of destruction that the Germans are inflicting. Okay, so 6th Army sends its Panzer Division, 16th, strikes all the way and reaches the Volga. You can see that it breaks through and gets just to here, leaving the Russians in sort of a pocket there where the Stalingrad is. Now, before they get here, I think it was on the 24th of September, the Luftwaffe has a massive bombardment of the city. Just really, I mean, like 1,000 planes, a huge raid. Flattens just about everything. There's a myth about tanks being manufactured at the tractor factory. They were, but up until that point, there was just the bombing destroyed that capability. The only thing they could do after that is repair tanks, okay? Because they had the tools to do it. So they would repair a tank, and it would drive out of the factory and right into the battlefield. But there was no manufacturing of tanks on a production line during the battle. So the Germans reach the Volga, and this is where... This should have been it. That's it. The city's destroyed. Its industrial capacity is destroyed. The railroad has been cut, okay? All the requirements have been met. And what does your boss say? Your boss says to Paulus, take the city.
But.
Okay. Yeah. What happened to all the guys who didn't listen to their boss? What are you going to do? I think you're going to try and take the city. Now, at this point, the 62nd Army is just being reformed again. And the losses they suffered going back to the city, they basically lose the 62nd Army again, okay? That's the second time, through just attrition. These units in here are really, really cut to pieces. You know, tank corps down to 15 tanks, okay? Infantry divisions down to the equivalent of a battalion left. Even guards, rifle divisions. So they're very weak, and so Paulus says, just break into the city and take it. And the 71st, hey, let's see if I have that, this, the next... Well, you know what? What I'm going to do is I talked about the 4th Air Fleet. This is what's left, okay? It's basically gutted. And you can see that, you know, it's just pretty much useless. Even for sheltering your own troops, it's not going to be much use, right?
About 4,000 Russian civilians were killed in that particular
war. In just that one raid. I mean, there's going to be... And they were not allowed to...
Almost of that Hamburg.
Well, yes, and they were not allowed to evacuate.
Yeah.
So many more, tens of thousands of civilians are going to die. Okay. Oh, and here we go. Here's who we're up against. Now, a lot of people write incorrectly that it was von Paulus. Every German's a von, okay? That's a nobility title. In other words, it's like Erich von Manstein. He was actually adopted by the von Mansteins, but the reason they became von Manstein is because they were nobility. That's how you can recognize Prussian nobility, is like von, okay? He's just a middle-class guy who went to school in the military academy, went up the ranks, and just, you know, became... A general, eventually a field marshal, and then we have the commander of the 62nd Army, Vasily Chuikov, who is sent to Stalingrad because the prior guy is just, he's so defeated. I mean, he's just so defeated, he just can't see how to hang on to things. So they decide, okay, rather than shoot him, they actually show humanity. You know, here they just simply take the guy somewhere where he can rest and build up his strength and take over another command. But Chuikov comes in and they said, hold the city. That's all you have to do. Because strategically, the Russians always, the Soviet Stavka, always had a wonderful grasp of strategy. And they're saying, this is pointless, right? But you know what? If the Germans want to get sucked into the city, we'll let them weaken themselves, and we will then counterattack, and like we did at Moscow, and that's the plan. Ironically, guess who also knows that? A lot of Germans who are already saying this, right? Don't get sucked into this. Don't get sucked into this. But Paulus, yes.
Okay. So where did Stavka get that idea of defending the city when before they wouldn't?
No, they were going to... because they... up to this point... Once it was destroyed, it didn't matter.
Okay. Now I get it.
Right.
It was the air raid that did it.
Once the city was destroyed... You're just holding on to basically a broken down, destroyed facility that there's no value to it. You might as well fight.
Yeah.
So different personalities here. Chuikov is going to have to come up with several different ways tactically to fight the Germans, to delay this and to gobble up their men and force them to keep sending more troops in. Okay, that's his job. And Paulus is going to try and make Hitler happy. That's it. And of course, like I said, Hoth over at 4th Panzer Army is going, dude, don't do this. Do not do this. You know, especially don't send my Panzer divisions, if they're not your Panzer divisions, they're mine. It's like, don't do this. They shouldn't be in the city. He's going to do it. So Paulus is going to grind up his army, because what was the other option he had besides not going into the... just sitting outside the city?
Going home and cutting this road.
No, going over the river.
Go around the south.
On the other side of the river. The Russians actually believe that they're going to do this. I'll show you at what point this happens. But, you know, it's so obvious. Remember, there's a lot of things about strategy that don't take genius, you know, because you can see, well, the way they could screw me, this is like Wargamers, right, is if they tried to take the city, so I better reinforce it, right?
Well, actually, one of the things I read recently, I was studying, was the Paulus was raised as a staff officer, and his first command position was the 6th Army.
Right.
And he didn't think like a commander. He thought in terms of minutiae and technicalities.
Yes.
And he didn't think in terms of the big picture.
That's part of it, but remember, your boss, okay. Yeah. No, technically, von Weichs is his boss, right? Army Group B, right over his head. What's this guy doing? Nothing. Okay, there's no communication. This guy is not saying, you know what, we're going to go across the river and I order 4th Panzer Army to take its 2 corps and hop across the river. That's all it would have taken, okay? They could have had a more creative way to do this, but nobody wants to try something. Why? Because if Hitler didn't think of it and it goes pear-shaped, you're done, okay? And they're all ready to write their memoirs at this point. Germany's won World War II in their mind. I mean, that's it. If you would ask any of these guys in 42, basically 3,000 miles into Russia, whether they were going to lose World War II, they would have laughed at you, right? In fact, there's a lot of people in the United States that would have laughed at you, right? Because it looked pretty bleak for the Allies in 42. So basically, what happens is the 71st Infantry Division and the 24th Panzer go bang right into the middle of the city, okay? And you can see the pocket that's around the city. And they get right downtown, and at this very moment, the Russians send just enough reinforcements, a fresh 13th Guards Rifle Division. The best troops they've got go right in there, head-to-head, and in wargaming terms, it's an exchange. Basically, the 71st Infantry Division is basically eliminated, and the 13th Guards. There's remnants that sit there in the middle of the city, but the Germans have taken basically the central and most of the south, because you can see the 29th Motorized and 94th take this whole area of the south. This is where the grain elevator, where the Russians held up inside of it and delayed them, but all of this is basically gone. Bang. Yes?
We missed the drama of the 13th Guards crossing the river in daylight under Stuka attack.
Yes, they lost a lot of guys just crossing the Volga River.
They lost 47 divisions just going across. And it was unprecedented. There was no time. There was no time to wait for the evening stages. They had to do it right then.
Yes.
And Robinson,
they had no choice. They had no time. They got slaughtered.
Robinson said, I'm going first, and the division's following me. Guys are running this whole thing. I'm in front. And they did it in daylight under Stuka attack.
And what is the first scenario in squad leader?
The
guards counterattack. Which guards would they be? The 13th, okay? So just a little tribute for you. You can tell people that and you want to impress them playing squad leader. Okay.
Did you just die? There was someone who just died who was a legal installment guy, so I'll open the economist. Does that ring
it wouldn't be Chukov. He died a long time ago.
Okay.
Paulus died a long time ago. Okay?
Right.
So, no. I don't think anyone high ranking. Those guys were all in their 40s and 50s in World War II. They didn't last till now.
But this map and this discussion and what he just said is all very fresh in my mind because some important person.
He could have been a 17-year-old guardsman. Okay.
Yeah.
More likely, he's a 17-year-old guardsman who was saying that I went across and he obviously survived, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So, World War II fits, like
right. So,
early 90s.
Anyway, so when they attacked in the south and they took the center of the city, they also captured the Red Communist Party headquarters. We've won. What would Vern Reckenau have done? We've won. There's only minor pockets left, right, Adolf? Call out the victory. We'll settle in here, and then we'll start digging in for the inevitable counterattack, right? And Hitler would have said what to his Nazi buddy?
Sure.
why not? Okay? But Paulus still has his orders. Has he taken the whole... Like you said, he's a staff officer. I have not checked every box. I have not taken every piece of Stalingrad. And that's what my orders are, right? So we're going to continue. So what he does is he brings in the 100th Jaeger or 100th Light Division, which is going to try and take Mamayev Kurgan, which is a Tartar burial mound. It's a man-made hill, huge, 102 meters, okay? Big. We don't know who's buried in there. I don't know why the Russians have never dug into that, because it's like there must be something in there buried. Or maybe they did dig into it and found there's no treasure, just some,
horse
bones and a guy's bones. That's it. Anyway, so this overlooks the whole river. So if you've got an observation post on this, you can just nail anything coming across during the daylight, okay? And you can also pinpoint things across the river and in the city. So the 100th Jaeger comes in, and it does what? Another fresh division, the 95th Rifle Division, comes in and exchange. There you go. There it is. I mean, doesn't take a genius to figure out what's happening here. Every week or so, there's an offensive. The Germans bite off another piece of the city, and they lose a division. Not completely. It just gets ground down so badly that it just can't be used for offensive purposes. Here's our buddies, the 24th Panzer, who are going to sweep along these... we don't see it here because there's a whole bunch of suburbs out here, smaller structures, but it swings out here, and of course, then the Germans, woohoo, we get a little pocket. Let's cut these guys. So the 16th Panzer, the 389th, are going to cut off the guys in the Orlovka. Russ Schulte, the guy I told you about, has the paybook of the commissar of the 2nd Motorized Rifle Brigade. He was the last guy to get out of that pocket before the Germans closed it. That guy survived. And Russ actually has the paybook of that guy. Amazing. I mean, it was a remarkable little find. The reason I think the artifacts are really cool when you can find things like this, So this is the kind of stuff that we're going to be able to show. So you can see, we bit off another chunk of the city, didn't we? What would von Reichenau say? Done, done, and done. Dig in, let's wait for the inevitable counterattack. Because I want this panzer division, and I want my infantry divisions at full strength, I want everybody ready for the winter counteroffensive, right? That would make sense. And what does Paula say? I have not taken the whole city. Okay? This is creep, mission creep. You probably have heard that expression, right? This is a classic case of mission creep. And Paulus is not going to check himself. And the guys who would check him, von Weichs above him, as Army Group B commander, is not saying anything. And Adolf actually is not sitting there harassing him on a regular basis. He's not telling Paulus to do this every day. He just said, take the rest of the city. I got other important things that I got to focus on, right? Because what's the big prize? It's down, you know, in the Caucasus where the oil fields are, right? That's where Adolf is paying attention. Plus, he has other crap going on that he has to worry about. He's more concerned about that. So, Paulus just carries on. Okay, so who are the guys doing the fighting? Yes, there are some tanks in the city. There are some self-propelled guns. But it's your infantry that's doing the basic fighting, okay? And a German squad looks like this. Rifle, lots of ammunition for what? Oh, wait, what's that? What was the big killer in World War I after artillery? Artillery was the biggest killer, but what was the second biggest killer?
Machine guns,
that's right. And so the Germans worked hard to develop a portable machine gun because in World War I they were big things. It took several guys to haul them around, weren't very flexible, but they also knew we needed to give every squad, not companies, not battalions, every squad of 6 to 12 guys have to have a machine gun because that's your firepower. It was all centered around this guy. German training was like this. Everybody was trained to use them. Everybody. So if that guy went down wounded or dead, another guy could pick it up and operate it. Okay? Usually the guy who got to do it first was the most accurate, the better one. And the commander of the unit, the squad, whether it was a sergeant or a lieutenant, his main job was, where do I place that machine gun? Depending on whether you're on the offense or the defense. Because that is going to make it possible for my squad to either accomplish its offensive mission or its defensive mission. Okay? So that's what the Germans are using. So how do the Russians counter this? Because the Germans are really good. They have radios. The Russians don't. They have machine guns and know how to use them. Right? So how do you counter that? You give everybody a machine gun, okay? So the Russian solution is, you've probably heard of the PPSH, it's a submachine gun. So the difference between a machine gun and a lot of the, like the M16 and other things we hear today, is the size of the round. These fire pistol ammunition, okay? It's a short round, it doesn't have a lot of gunpowder in it. It's also less accurate, but they don't care. How accurate do I have to be to fire across through a window into the next room, okay? Just spray as many rounds in there as you can. This whole unit of Russian soldiers has PPSHs, and that's what they tried to give as many of the guys as they could, were submachine guns. This is the real rise in firepower at the squad level. And they would take entire companies of these guys as a counterattacking force. So when the Germans broke in, these guys would come up. And again, the machine gun, at the very least, keeps other people's heads down. You don't have to be accurate if it makes people stop, if it makes people take cover, okay? So machine guns are important, so the Russians decide to give everybody a machine gun that they can. Obviously, they can't equip everybody, but it's the idea that they're increasing their firepower. The next thing that happens is, this is the distance. I mean, what is that? Maybe 100 yards at most? This guy with the Russians with the mortar is aiming right at it. And if he misses, he'll just adjust it and keep doing it until he hits it, right? It also means that if I'm a sniper in Stalingrad, what's the distance for a sniper? We're not talking 50 caliber sniper rifles in Afghanistan in a mile, okay? We're talking about me hitting in that. I could probably shoot somebody inside that window because when we go shooting out of the target range, we're doing it like 50 yards, okay? And we're worried that we got this close to, how close did we get to this, right? Well, if you've got something this big in that doorway, I could, you know, somebody could just hit it. So the snipers were the guys who actually could hit something with a rifle, whereas most people in Russia, strangely enough, weren't allowed to have weapons. So they didn't ever train until they got in the army, right? And the guys who had a better ability to hit things became snipers, okay? Again, not snipers like Worthy.
I have a great question for you.
Yeah.
About what percentage of the fought over area in the city of Stalingrad consisted of ruins like that building you see in front of you, and how much was more rubble or a thin layer of rubble thrown in the
streets? You could have, let's say that you had a force where, I'll go back real quick. I'll show you that
there, yeah.
Okay. All right, so.
I was wondering, how much was built up like this?
And how much was then totally collapsed?
I've got that on the run, that right
okay.
Corner.
All right, this is a square. This is like a, would be a park, okay? And so this is dangerous because you can see if you line up people in here trying to get across that would be pretty dangerous to come across because you're in the open and you're vulnerable, right? But you can also see a lot of the floors. There are no floors in some of these buildings because these have been burned out, right? So it's a mixture. If the area was hit hard by bombardment, by air bombardment, by artillery bombardment, you might have things that are nothing more than a shell, okay? And they're fighting on the first floor because that's the only one that exists. In other areas you might go into, it's untouched. I mean, it's just like a fire anywhere or bombardment anywhere. You'd have a perfectly intact building, even with its windows, and across the street is something totally gutted, okay? There was no, you can't go through and mark precisely because as soon as you start shooting, it starts knocking things down.
Right.
But the reason I also came back to here is something I wanted to show you. When the fighting continues, Chuikov's army, the 62nd Army, when he inherited it, okay, and it got reinforcements, is about 50,000 guys. Basically, a Russian army is not as big as a German army. It's like the size of a reinforced corps, okay? He is going to lose 50,000 men in the course of this battle. So it's going to be destroyed. That's the third time it's going to be destroyed. He will lose the equivalent of his entire army and have it reinforced to maybe 10 or 15,000 guys at the end when it's all over, okay? So they just knew they were going to sacrifice this. In the process, they're going to grind up 4 German infantry divisions and 1 panzer division. And when I say grind up, it's the guys who are in the combat units. Not the artillery, not the logistics, not the administration. It's going to be the guys right there in the infantry companies, right? In the combat units and the tankers and so forth. Okay, so not as many Germans are going to die. And of course, you know, there's some guys that say, well, you know, the Russian tactics are terrible, et cetera, et cetera. But I'm going to show you something that's ironic about fighting in a city. We always think that the defender has the advantage, right? If you're in a city, well, you get a +3 or you double your forces or whatever it is. It's actually the opposite, and here's why. Because if you want to hold this area right here, just go ahead and hold this, okay? You don't want the Germans going down there. Well, if you put guys back here, they can't see what's happening out here. So you have to put guys here, and not just one or two. You have to occupy almost every inch of that. Unlike the open terrain, where if you dig a hole or you're behind a tree or something, if a machine gun, you can basically arc your fire over a big area. So out in the open, you can use your observation post, you can call in artillery, and you can see things like a mile away. The furthest I can see is across this square or over here to these other buildings. And in fact, if I'm back here in reserve, what can I see? Not much. But if I don't have a reserve there and suddenly the Germans burst into one of these buildings here, I have to have that reserve in order to counterattack, to throw them back out again. Ironically, you have to use more soldiers in a city to hold it than the attackers because the attackers have the initiative. The Russians were always able to make raids and get through the German lines because there were no lines, you know? There was no reason to have lines. You would have groups of guys in like a pocket, like circle the wagons, okay? And the defenders had to spread their guys out more and put more in. They might have, in fact, there are maps the Germans showed where there were literally, in a building like this, they might have a couple hundred guys, 6 NA tank guns and so forth. Why? So that maybe 3 would survive, okay? Literally, so that you'd have enough survive to hold that. And it didn't work because the Germans, every time they wanted to take a piece of the city, they just threw a few shells in there, the Stukas hit them, and that was the other thing that Chuikov did, besides giving them more firepower, is he knew that the German air power was dominant. They didn't even have any way to fight those. What he did is he told his troops to hug the Germans. If there were Germans in this building, then you're in that building. And the reason for that is Stukas could not hit that accurately. So it eliminated the German advantage with air power.
This is the Vietnam lesson that the VC in North Vietnamese got was
hug the enemy
by their belts. Yeah.
Yes. Okay.
Okay. Close to the Americans.
Here's another scene from the sky. You can see that the oil's burning. This is the worst thing that almost happened to Chuikov. Is he was down in a gully. You can see the really deep, dry gullies. When the water runs, it just cuts these gullies really at a deep, steep angle. And the Russians had built in concrete bunkers, and he was in one of these. And the Germans bombarded these oil tanks. They're right above the gully, and the burning oil is flaming down into his headquarters, and he almost burned to death. Because no one checked to see if there was any fuel in these. They could have let it go, but they didn't do it. It was like, Winston Churchill had a wonderful quote. It says, the side that wins the war is the one that makes the fewest mistakes. Okay? So both sides are also making typical mistakes, and that's just human nature. Okay.
Headquarters across the river asked him where he was. He said, where the smoke is thickest.
Yes. Okay, so this is going to be one of the most successful attacks the Germans pull off. Not only are they going to be able to break through, but they're going to slice in behind the tractor factory and destroy the 37th Guards Rifle Division, even easier than the 13th Guards. How did this happen? The Soviets are also capturing guys, and they're listening to radio intercepts, and they know when their big offensive is coming, but they don't know where. They don't know where. So where would you attack if you were a smart commander? What did I say at the very beginning? Wouldn't you cross the river and cut off the city, right? And the Russians saying, the Germans are smart. So what we're going to do is be smarter. All of our artillery on this side of the river dug in, so the barrels are the only thing poking out, right? We can't turn it around to shoot at the Germans if they're coming from this side. We're going to move all our artillery so we don't lose it. So they pulled all their artillery out and moved it back, because they thought the Germans were going to do the smart thing and cross the river. And what happened? Paulus, okay, this is not the smartest brick on the wall, right? Okay, so what does he do? Hey, diddle, diddle, up the middle. And the Germans with the 14th Panzer, it's not enough that I killed my 16th and my 24th Panzer, let's get rid of the 14th Panzer. It attacks along with the 305th Infantry Division. Bang, they break through, split up, half of it goes behind the tractor factory, and that's how they destroy the 37th Guards rifle, is because it's cut off. They're not going to get any more food, they're not going to get any more water, they're not going to get any more ammunition. So after a few days, they're done, and that was the end of that rifle division. The only thing that holds out is the Red October factory, right here in the middle. And they bring in the 79th Infantry Division, because again, what is Paulson doing? I'm almost done. I almost have everything, right? Every couple weeks I'm going to do this. You can just see this. Everyone on the German side is living with Paulus. Von Weichs is not saying anything, right? And Hitler's like distracted. So, the very last attack, which is called Operation Hubertus, everyone knows the counterattack is coming. The last thing they do is try and take the Red October. This is all that's left. This is all that Chuikov has left, is this narrow little strip of the city, okay? But he still technically has a piece of the city. It is not going to capture totally. So they bring in the 79th Infantry Division, and they also organize special groups. And this is the group, the 179th Pioneer Battalion. That means combat engineer. These guys have flamethrowers, they've got the explosive charges, they're trained to specifically go against hardened targets. And this is right off of the map. This is part of the complex. These factories are not just one giant factory. It's a complex of buildings. And when my buddy Russ Schultz was doing the research, he found out that there were waste. He actually found the construction templates. Obviously, in the Soviet Union, everything is planned. So there were ways and ways to build, like, apartment buildings and market buildings and factories. Factories had enormously thick concrete walls, okay? Holding up these. The easy thing was just, if you don't have super skill in engineering, you use really thick walls to hold the steel beams. And that's what they were doing. So these are very thick walls. And the German plan was this. You can see the dotted land, the dotted line is squad number one is going this way and then going over here. Squad number four is in this crater and is going to go this way, and the other squads are going to go in. It all goes to hell because what the Germans do not realize is inside of there, the equipment has already been hollowed out into pillboxes. So you have iron-like casting things that have... The only thing that sticks out is like a hole where a machine gun or a PPSH can stick out, okay? And there's so many Russians packed in there that the Germans do this assault. You have the first bombardments with your artillery, with your mortars, and they try to go forward. So the first group comes around, and they're supposed to get to this crater and then go up here. Well, when they get to the crater, they're pinned down completely by fire coming out the windows. The Russians are just hosing the area down blindly, and these guys say, screw that, and they just sit in the crater. That's it. That's the end of this operation for them. The other guys try to go out and do their job on the other side. They get this far, and the Russians just can't see. They're just firing out these windows, and these guys are ducking down, and they turn around and say, screw that, and they go back to their hole. Okay, so both flanks are now gone. There's not really a lot of casualties at this point. It's just mostly firing blindly, okay? So another group of Germans go up here, and they're supposed to break into this one, and they do. They break into the door. They use their explosives. They charge in, and guess what happens? All hell breaks loose, just enormous. When you read the actual, you know, after-action report, it talks about the guys coming into the room, and they were just met by a huge amount of firepower coming at them. So what do? You can see. They get in, they turn around and go right back out again. So that's the end of their job, right? So we're now down to one squad, you know, out of your battalion, out of the company of making this attack. And they go up here and they decide, you know what? We're not going through the door. We're going to blow a hole in the wall, okay? Boom! No effect. It's like, oops, that doesn't work. Because why? Because it's a piece of concrete that lie. So they decide, damn it. So they also blow in the door. What happens? All right? And they go, hell with this, and they go out the other door. And they take off. That's the whole operation, okay? The Germans have a couple killed, a few guys wounded, and that's the end of this. And they said, you know what? They can have this damn building. This is just ridiculous, right? The Russians, we have no idea whether any of them were killed. We don't know because records are not kept as well on the Russian side. But, you know, again, the point is, this was just a mindless operation. It makes no sense. This is something you'd expect from World War I, where it's like, you know, take the other trench just because you're supposed to take the other trench, right? The guys on the ground, the guys there, said, screw this. Paulus, meanwhile, is going to... He's already planning for the next assault, yeah. Okay? Meanwhile, everybody sees massive numbers of Russians piling up on his flanks and tanks, which, by the way, this is the steppes of Russia. There's no forest to hide in, right? It's like, okay, I see hundreds of tanks out here. I wonder what they're going to do with those, right? So what happens is, of course, the Germans have now ground themselves down into... weakened infantry divisions that cannot withstand the counterattack, and Paulus's three panzer divisions are all beaten up so badly they can't counterattack. And you're going to say, but Dana, what about the 4th Panzer Army? It doesn't get surrounded. This guy knows what's coming. So what does he do? Good luck! I hope you have a good winter. See you, Paulus, okay? And he takes off with the 4th Panzer Army, and his units don't get encircled. Now, this all happens while von Weichs is doing... What did he do before?
Nothing.
What is he doing now?
Nothing.
Very good, class. That's right. He's doing nothing, okay? Okay, and Hitler decides to get involved at this point, because Goering says, remember, what did he say, and they were able to do in 41? I can supply them by air. So what does Goering say now?
I can supply them by air,
right? Of course, they can't. It's like to take an army of 250,000 men. And by the way, there were Russian prisoners who decided to work for the Germans, not fight for them. Although there are actually some companies of Russians that fight for the Germans, physically will fight for them. But most of them just become hewies, they call them, Hilfigers, who are basically volunteers to help move stuff so that it frees up German trained troops to be replacements in the companies and battalions where they need them. Anyway, these guys also have to be fed too, right? So at the very least, they need 700 tons a day of food and ammunition and petrol and all the things that you need to sustain an army. And the bottom line is the best they ever got up to, the best was 500 tons in one day. Otherwise, it never got close. So they were pretty much done. And the net result, of course, is that Paulus never breaks out, never tries to break out. Von Manstein tries to relieve the pocket, and of course he can't make it because he doesn't have enough forces. And an army. The first time the Germans lose, I mean, this is not just a few, you know, this is not like troops in the field that suffer casualties. Entire divisions, their staffs, their cadres, their information, that learned experience that took years to develop in combat and in campaign after campaign, that's all gone. Now, they do rebuild some of the divisions for propaganda purposes, like that 79th Division is rebuilt, for example. The 24th is rebuilt, the 24th Panzer, 16th Panzer is rebuilt, and 14th. And some of the people that are used to rebuild it are flown out of the pocket in order to be the cadre to make these rebuilt divisions. But a lot of these divisions are gone. There's no more 350.
How can they land planes there and fly them out?
Well, they had the pocket there at Stalingrad is really big. Okay. Let me go back.
And show them Rapp Airfield, which is like
the biggest. There's more than that. Gumrak was just the biggest. Let me go back, and I will show you when we look at the big map. Anyway. Okay. So the pocket. Here's Gumrak. Okay? But the pocket is like way out here like this, okay? It's all the way out there. Because remember, these divisions out here are going to fold back, including Romanians, and form part of the pocket, okay? And that's going to be the pocket at Stalingrad. It's going to be many, many miles. And so the airfields initially are miles and miles away from the front line, even though they're inside the pocket. And therefore, the only thing that's going to affect them are going to be any aircraft as they approach the area and the Russian Air Force, which is not very effective. They're going to lose a lot of aircraft, like 1,000 aircraft are going to get basically shot down or mostly damaged. They're going to suffer a lot of crashes due to landing, okay, on obviously bad fields in winter. But they are able to sustain them until the beginning of February, and Hitler decides his solution to this is, I'm going to promote Paulus, right? Remember all the guys who didn't do what he said?
Field marshal.
I'm going to make him a field marshal, right? And Paulus pisses him off. Why? Because he surrenders. And Hitler's like, no field marshal surrenders, ever. He should have killed himself, right? The good news is, you're promoted to field marshal. The bad news is, you now have to kill yourself. And Paulus, how dare he? And it got worse. Because what did Paulus do? He was so disillusioned by Hitler and obeying his orders that he became the head of the German anti-Nazi group that the Russians used as propaganda to try and get Germans to switch in World War II. Okay? Never really worked. I mean, it's like Axis Sally and what was it, Lord Ha-Ha, you know, and the others that are trying to influence the enemy. He was trying to do that with German soldiers by telling them, you know, I was there, I'm part of you, I'm a comrade, and you need to desert, come over to, you know, the Russians. It's, you're stupid fighting for the Nazis. Yes?
One point I read in one of the more recent books I read about Stalingrad, I think it was written, you know, published in 2011, maybe 2013, was that Paulus was too far back and too detached in the fighting and really didn't understand what's going on. Choiko was up front. This made for a much faster reaction time. He said, basically, I was thinking about this and how it put it in war game. This is before I learned that, you know, that's a big
Thing existed. No, it makes a big difference.
And what I was thinking was that, in terms of a smaller scale game, if the Germans have to give their orders in one turn in advance.
Well, here's what would happen. Here's what Paulus would do. Every time they wanted to take a piece of the city, they did. They did. Because they were at the end of a very long supply line, okay, hundreds and hundreds of kilometers. So it took time to bring up enough ammunition, particularly artillery shells, so that they could get another offensive. Because that's what they did. The typical was you bombard the crap out of an area, right, with both planes and artillery, and after you do that, you make your assaults with self-propelled guns or tanks supported by infantry and pioneers, combat engineers, with flamethrowers and so forth. And so, because they get to choose where they're going to do this, Paulus is involved in planning it. This is where we're going to do it. And then he let his division corps commander, each of the guys were able to do their thing, and he just stood back and let them do it. He was hands-off, okay? And it's not necessarily a bad thing, because at least the guys in each location decided which building to go in, okay? Chuikov is right there. He literally is within round. He's within shooting distance. Okay, which meant that he, on the one hand, could send out couriers, okay, messengers, and he also had his own PPSH company that he could use to send forward as a reinforcement. Okay,
right. The only way he had communications was with Russia.
Yes, but his communications was limited also because remember the tractor factory. He has no way to communicate with these guys because the Russians don't have as many radios. Mm-hmm. And they don't have, and the guy can't just walk down there, right? It's within walking distance, but how do you get there? You have to duck a lot of shooting and firepower and so forth. So, and how will you know he gets there? Chuikov is fighting this battle on one level, very much like a World War I battle. You can imagine that. I only know what's in my trench. Okay? And I have to send guys forward. When will I know they get there? Maybe a flare? Okay? They can't call me back. There's not enough radios, okay? So I don't even know if they're there. The Germans, on the other hand, have radios with them. So I have my company, and I've got my guy with his radio, right? And the guys go forward, and they take the next building, and I move forward. And I can go, we're on point, whatever it is, you know, grid number, blah, blah, okay? Right, okay, so the Germans were able to chop off whatever they wanted to. It's just that the Russians were able to kill and wound enough of them, all right, to stop that at some point. Because the Germans say, screw this, because they weren't going to fight to the last man. But when you have these kind of steady casualties, after 2.5 months, battalions are no longer at 800 guys. They're not at 400 guys. They're not at 200 guys. There are 100 guys, equivalent of a company, is all that's left. An understrength company is all that's left in a battalion of German troops because of steady losses. Not just all killed, but also wounded, right? By the way, if you were wounded in Stalingrad, it probably was a good thing, because where do you end up?
Yeah.
Woohoo! Recovering in Germany, thank you, right? When everything went to pear shape. Anyway, I have the sample game here that I'd love to show you. I also have some sign-up sheets if you'd like to get on the list. I have a Civil War book that is in the production right now. It'll be out in October.
What's the subject?
It's called Grant Rising. It's a map book about Grant's early life, his Mexican War, and Civil War career up through the end of 1862, okay, and why he became such a well-known figure in America at that time. We have a Napoleonic book on Borodino next, and we're going to have a series on World War II that we're putting together with David Glantz. So,
that I'd like to see.
All you have to do is mark that you're interested in World War II. Just put your name and an email address there, and we will absolutely fill you in. You can see that here's what your interest group, books or games, and what period. Okay. And you can just put your email there, and I will be glad to update you. And I also would be happy to answer any questions. Thank you so much for listening. Any questions?
So at the end there, it's February.
Yes.
How much of the pocket to the west of the city was actually occupied by the Germans?
The Russians got caught attacking. They were smart. There was no reason to keep attacking in the pocket. It just loses men. And they were not going to just attack for the sake of attacking. They had the Germans trapped. Their job was to keep them basically prisoners. They had a big prison camp. Yes. Sooner or later, the Germans are going to have to surrender. So why is that?
And Goering was not air supplying the people in the
They
pocket.
Tried.
I mean,
the Luftwaffe, on one hand, people laugh about Goering, but the Luftwaffe just absolutely sacrificed a huge number of aircraft and pilots.
Again, the Russians overran the main German airfield supplying Stalingrad with the whole tank division.
Right.
Well, actually, at the time, there were only 10 tanks with about 10 rounds of ammunition left. But because you had 200 German aircraft in this field, suddenly discovering a Russian tank division waddling up the airfield, and they panicked. Dozen German planes came down from mid-air collisions trying to take off.
Yeah, so it was a disaster. I mean, it was not going to work out well for the Germans. This whole thing from the very beginning didn't make any sense.
No.
Like I said, it was mission creep. It was unnecessary mission creep. There are reasons why this happened the way it did, but it's a combination of utter contempt for your enemy, of being scared of your loss, of, you know, keep it. It's a whole bunch. The German commanders all of a sudden became Wallys. You know Wally and Dilbert? Okay? He doesn't do anything. He sits in his cubicle, comes up with a million reasons why he doesn't do anything, but they never fire him, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
So, and they didn't have an army group commander to coordinate Paulus and Hoth.
Yeah. No. He wasn't going to do anything.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Now you see why.
That did.
But at the time, it was like the German army's on a roll, and you know, it's just not working out the way they want to. Germany is not fully mobilized, okay? They have not fully mobilized their country. You know, the United States and Russia is 24-7. They have three 8-hour shifts in factories every day. No such thing in Germany. Why? Because we don't want the German people to suffer. Remember we talked about it, if some of you were here, that Denmark supplied all the bacon and butter you wanted? What was rationed over here? You couldn't get butter. In fact, isn't that where margarine was created in World War II? Because they didn't have enough butter? Okay? Not in Germany, man. They stripped Europe to keep their people happy. Why? Hitler's main belief is that the reason of the collapse in World War I is that the home front collapsed. Its will to fight and support the army collapsed because they were suffering. And he said, we are not going to make the people suffer. When the British bombed Hamburg and other cities and just gutted them, killing tens of thousands of people and making more homeless, who was there with blankets, food, and shelter to put them in someplace safe away from the city? Immediately. The Nazis. No, the Nazis. The Nazi party, the infrastructure, okay, was there. All I know about the British is they're killing us. Helpless civilians, right? Indiscriminately. And the Nazis have come, have given my children food, have given them clothing, right? They're going to take us somewhere safer in the countryside, just like the British, you know, emptied London, right? So who are you going to like? I mean, this is just human nature.
And also, you only hear rumors of other cities being bombed, not an actuality of that.
Well,
even during the heavy bombing, the Germans didn't feel like they were under as much
threat
as they
were. Not everyone. It wasn't until 45 they'd hammered just about every city, but it took time to do that. Okay, so yes, you hear about things like that, but it took time to build up to those kind of indiscriminate bombings. Anyway, that's my talk. Thank you so much for listening. And I, you know, if you have any interest in, I'll show you the Stalingrad game for Tide Wire. Thank you.
Hi. And that incorporates a lot of the stuff that you've been telling us, the new stuff that you've been
telling us. This is a tactical game. So we're talking about the guys with the PPSHs. We're talking about one part of the building is occupied by the Russians, the other part's occupied by the Germans and trying to fight and take over. This is like in the sewers. This is like tactical fighting. Like when you were a boy and you had toy soldiers. Okay, it's filled with toy soldiers. Who doesn't want to play with plastic toy soldiers and tanks, right? That's what's in here.
Individual tanks.
That's individual tanks. So that's what's in that game. Anyway, so that's the story. Thank you so much for listening.
Thank you.
And tomorrow we'll have even more.